Welcome to the Corner of Film podcast. I'm Niall from Corner of Film, which is a film website where I write about film. Today, I'm joined once again by Oliver from Oliver's Reviews. Hello.
Hello. Thank you for having me again.
Hello. No, it's wonderful to be here with you. Before we start anything, I'm just going to preface this by saying I am still a little bit unwell. You might hear it in my voice. If I do go quiet, it's probably because I've muted the mic and am coughing horribly. So apologies for that. We also should just put out, before we start talking, we're going to be talking about Eternals today. So big, big spoiler warning for Eternals. If you've not seen it and you don't want it spoiled, maybe don't listen, because we're going to be talking about post-credit sequences. We're going to be talking about plot twists, and we're going to spoil it in basically every way. So if you don't want it spoiled, then fair warning. So Oliver, Eternals came out on Friday last week. We've both seen it. What was your overall impression?
I really loved it. Well, I always try to see an MCU film twice before gaining an opinion, and I only had the opportunity to watch it once, but I did really love it.
Yeah.
What did you think?
Yeah, I'm in two minds about it, actually. I understand why it's so divisive. I think it's got some really good points. I also think it's got some really not good points. And yeah, I think really I need to pick it apart to be able to have an opinion. Mostly I'd say I'm on the fence. So
okay, that's fair. Yeah.
Yeah, so I figured we could start by doing some pros and cons. Why don't you chuck some pros at me, and I'll see. I've got a list here, so we'll see if we match up.
Okay. Well, some of my biggest pros, actually my biggest pro, I would say, is I thought that the film did a really great job at balancing 10 major characters all at once. I enjoyed all the characters, all the performances, and didn't feel like anyone really needed more or less time. I thought everyone was balanced really, really well.
You see, so I've got that the characters were interesting and that the acting was really good, and that the characters were quite layered, but that the layering I felt was done more by implication, and that there wasn't as much exploration as I would have liked of, you know, specifics. And I get that they're a team, but I did feel a little bit like it was quite a bloated film. There was a lot going on, but I didn't really feel like any of them got the time that they needed. I thought they all did a really good job. Every actor was incredible. Every character was well done. I went away feeling like actually I wanted more. I wanted to see more of that, which they couldn't have fit into one film. But yeah, I'm in two minds about that as well.
Do you think maybe the reason why you left wanting more could actually be because you enjoyed the characters to the point of they could all stand their ground on their own? Because I think that's what I wanted a lot.
Yeah, I think that's fair. I mean, I liked, in particular, I had a few favourites, but mostly there was something about each of them that I thought, okay, but I want to know more about that. You know, I wanted to explore a bit more of, I thought Angelina Jolie was amazing as Thena, but I just felt like there was so much going on for that character that just wasn't really addressed. And it was sort of, it was there. You could see it was there. There's sort of a lot of implications of what she's going through of, you know, there's that sort of allegory for like dementia and that sort of thing. And I thought it was really good, but it just wasn't, it felt like it was a whole arc that was done in about 20 minutes of screen time. Which, and again, there's no real fix for that, because it's a team film. It's, you know, it's about the 10 of them. It's not about any one. And for them to work as a team, they all need to be in the same film. But equally, it felt like a lot of them didn't quite have what they needed. Maybe I felt like Druig and Makari were both sort of sidelined, really. They didn't really do an awful lot. But they're sort of set up, I think, to kind of be a lot bigger in a sequel. So, yeah, there's a balance to it, I think, which is, it was difficult to strike. And I don't think they could have done it any better. But I think maybe it was just a little bit too ambitious. I'm not sure exactly how I feel about it, really.
Yeah, no, I get that. I think, when there's that many characters, the only way to do it justice is a team film. Because yeah. I, even though like Cersei and Icarus are basically the leads of the film, I don't really think there is a lead of the film because of it being a team yeah. film. They're the heads of the team, maybe, but not specifically the leads of the film.
No, yeah, I think, yeah, I didn't feel that they were... I think if someone asked me, okay, but who's the main character? I guess I would say Cersei because it's sort yeah. of framed by her experience. But generally, I don't feel that it necessarily puts any one of them at the forefront. I just think some of them are given very little screen time or attention. I enjoyed what it did do with the time it had. And to be honest, I think if it had been any longer, I would have checked out anyway. So yeah, it's a difficult one because I thought, actually this is probably one of my biggest pros is I thought the casting was excellent.
Yeah.
100%. Yeah. I couldn't fault a single actor that was cast in that film. I thought Kumail Nanjiani, I thought he was excellent as Kingo, like absolutely spot on. Just a lot of fun. And again, they, you know, I mean, I know you've read the comic, the source material. I'm not as familiar with it, but yeah. I know they changed. He was originally Japanese, am I right?
See, the one I read was Neil Gaiman's Eternals, and if I'm yeah. not mistaken, Kingo's not actually in that one.
Oh, right.
So Neil Gaiman's one has Icarus, Cersei, Sprite, and a couple others, but I don't think they're not ones that appear in this film from my memory. So yeah. I think they kind of picked and chose specific yeah. elements of like Neil Gaiman's run and the original like Jack Kirby proper yeah. original stuff. And actually I read it the day before I went into the film. So it was quite fresh in my mind.
Okay.
And Cersei's story is like her character is relatively the same as it is in Neil Gaiman's version.
Yeah.
Even down to like the when she figures out that she can transfigure things into living things or turn living yeah. things into non-living things.
Right.
That was ripped straight from the pages of Neil Gaiman's Eternals. And I haven't seen anyone mention that.
No, see, because I think Eternals aren't one. I think they're one that people are aware of sort of peripherally maybe, but not, yeah. it's not one that people are overly familiar with, which I think is, in terms of sort of the MCU and making films, I think they're doing exactly what they need to be doing. They're picking out the characters that are maybe, I mean, it's essentially what they did with Phase 1 again. It's, you know, Iron Man was a B-list, C-list hero, and they made him an A-list hero.
Yeah.
They sort of, you know, started the team with him and then started introducing slightly more well-known characters sort of after the fact. And I think that's essentially what it looks like Phase 4 is going to be. And, you know, Eternals come in first and Shang-Chi, who again, is not the most well-known character. And then they're going to introduce, you know, Fantastic Four, Blade, some of the sort of slightly more well-known in terms of pop culture, sort of bigger heroes, which I think is ultimately, I think that is a really good decision. In terms of the MCU, though, this is my biggest kind of con against the film was it didn't really link much to the wider MCU. I felt like it was almost a standalone film.
I found it like a standalone film, but I actually thought it linked pretty well in terms of, like, we don't get much reference to the outside world. Like, you could watch Eternals as your first ever MCU film and be fine going yeah. forward. But I thought that's why it actually worked really well, because you had little references to, like, Thanos, and yeah. Thanos, the snap itself being the reason why I forget the name now.
Ajak?
Yeah, when Ajak is telling Icarus about the celestial in Earth, the yeah. emergence, that's what it's called.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
When Thanos basically delaying the emergence, like, that's quite a fun, interesting linking point.
Yeah.
That if you've not seen the MCU stuff before, it won't mean much, but it doesn't really matter going forward. And I think my biggest takeaway from this film was the Celestials, because we haven't had much of them in the franchise so far. and obviously nothing to this extent
no.
at all. And I think it does a really good job at building the groundwork for a whole new cosmic side of the MCU that it will never be the same, I don't think.
No, but then I think, I mean, for me, I guess that a lot of it is I need to see where it's going before I can really sort of say, obviously they've got a plan and we don't know what that plan is yet. We can sort of guess and assume and extrapolate, but it's, you know, it might be that they are basically going to come back around and tie it back later on, in which case I think Eternals will, when you go back and watch it, feel a little bit out of place. Whereas if they are moving on, you know, sort of broadly speaking, it will feel like a fresh start, in which case it will probably seem a lot more justified. So I guess that it all really depends on where they go next, like you say. But no, I agree that they, in terms of scope, in terms of scale, I think it did a good job of broadening what the MCU encompasses. I think, you know, I liked the way that they introduced the Celestials. I think you get a good idea of the sort of scale that shot towards the end of the what's his name? Ooh, the big Celestial. Something with an A.
Something the Judge.
Yeah. When he sort of appears at the end and he makes the Earth look tiny, mm-hmm. that is a good, I think, sort of, that was a moment where I kind of clicked like, oh, okay, I see where they're going with this. That's pretty impressive. Yeah, I felt a little bit like, I guess this is the reason that I'm on the fence, really, is that everything that I'm sort of, that I like, everything that I don't like, it's all sort of dependent on what they do next and sort of, is it setting up this or is it setting up that? Because if it's setting up this very specific thing, then great. But if it's setting up something else, then it's not as good. And I think that's part of the problem for me in terms of how it didn't really link too much to the MCU, the sort of pre-existing films, is that I kind of felt a bit like, okay, but I have no idea where the Eternals fit into things other than, you know, the sort of throwaway line about why they didn't interfere, which I thought was a kind of silly, but they had to explain it. They had to address it as sort of why they didn't come in. And I thought, well, I mean, that's obviously what they're doing. They're explaining, you know, why the Eternals have sort of just let everything happen and not stepped in. But it felt a bit cheap, but they couldn't have done it any other way. And I think with that sort of thing, you've just got to sort of laugh and go, oh, well, yeah, fair enough. But yeah, I'm not sure exactly how I feel about it, really. I mean, those are kind of my pros and cons. We've kind of been over them now. But I think we should probably talk a little bit about the review bombing and the representation and that whole mess there. So, what are your thoughts on the review bomb?
I think it's quite laughable, really, that these people that are meant to be professionals have actually gone out of their way to put basically fake hatred out there for what amounts to 5 seconds of screen time. You know, this film is the first film since Iron Man to even have a sex scene in it.
Yeah.
And the sex scene wasn't even mentioned, as it was a straight scene. But then you go on for a 5-second gay kiss, and that's where you're getting the backlash from.
It's a joke. You're right. Yeah, it's insane. It's absolute lunacy. I think it really highlights society's problems more than it does the film's problems. Now, again, like I just said, I don't think that Eternals is one of the best Marvel films. I don't know that it's, you know, all this stuff about, oh, it's the worst one and it's got the worst, is it Rotten Tomatoes? It's the worst love.
Yeah.
But I don't think that's fair. I think it's a lot better than the likes of, you know, The Incredible Hulk, and there's a couple of films that I think are worse, definitely. But it's not a perfect film. But no, I think if that's the thing you want to pick out as an issue, then there is something wrong with you as a person.
Exactly, yeah. Like, I looked through the Rotten Tomatoes critics' reviews on the day that it got certified rotten, and like a good 50% of them didn't have valid things in them. Like, obviously there are lots of valid criticisms to this film, but lots of them were just things that aren't criticisms and are just poking at it or blatantly just being homophobic.
Yeah, well, see, this is my... So, I mean, the review bombing was done before it was even released. So that's done by people who haven't seen the film, probably won't even bother to go and see it. They just know that it contains something that they have taken offence to, and so they're going to trash it before it's even off the ground.
Yeah.
So, to me, I take sort of quite a neutral stance on representation, because I think it needs to be done, but I think it needs to be done for the right reasons, not just because... Oh, well, we've noticed we've not got enough sort of inclusion in our casting and we've not been doing it properly. So now we're going to overcorrect for the sake of it. I think it needs to be done properly, which I personally think Eternals did really well.
Definitely, yeah.
I thought, so Fastos is he's the gay hero. And so the whole storyline about him sort of falling in love and he starts a family and... It serves a purpose. It's not just done as like a, oh, look, now we have a gay hero. If that was the case, I'd understand why people would have an issue, because that is just sort of tokenism. That's not representation. Yeah. You know, that's tokenism. But it's done as a means of showing that he has, it's sort of all to do with his journey of he is protecting mankind and then he realizes actually maybe they're not worth protecting. And he sort of hides himself away, but then he falls in love and that makes him reevaluate. But also the fact that it's a gay relationship is, again, I think it speaks to the general themes there, in that he is finding a place that accepts him, except it doesn't completely accept him. It's sort of, it's a microcosm of what he was thinking about humanity, in that, you know, you can find some good there, but also you're going to be surrounded by hate at the same time. And I thought there was a lot of themes that came in with the fact that he was gay that worked sort of on a deeper level. It wasn't just done as a, okay, there you go, there's a gay hero, stop moaning about it. It made sense, you know. It was done properly. It wasn't done in a way that was, you know, oh, look, he's gay, like you really need to see how gay he is. It was just done as, he's a hero, he's gay, there's a point to the fact that he has a husband. It doesn't need examining any closer than that. And I think the fact that people were getting so upset about it just proves that they've done it right.
Yes. Yeah. 100%. They did it exactly how you would go about writing a straight relationship in a film. And that's why it works. And that's why people are mad, because they're not stereotyping to any degree. They're not pushing it. Because that's not something you would do in a straight relationship in a film when you're writing it. So why would you do it as a gay relationship, which is why people are getting so mad? Because it's done exactly how life works.
It's, well, that's the thing. It's done to humanize the character. It's, you know, they're not human, but they're part of humanity by choice. And the way to humanize them is to put them in a relationship with a human. So,
yeah.
You know, there you go, there's your human. There it works. There, it doesn't need to be any more than it is, and it was done really well. The obviously the other sort of representation is, it is a very diverse cast, and the first disabled superhero as well. Well, not technically, because obviously, so this is something that I actually did want to talk about, is I've been rewatching the MCU, and I've just watched Infinity War, so I'm right up now to Endgame again. And I'd completely forgotten the whole storyline about Rhodey and sort of paralysis, and I'd completely forgotten that happened. And I felt a little bit uncomfortable watching the scene where he's like learning to walk again with the prosthetics and I was just thinking, oh, I don't like that. That's just feels wrong. Like, you know,
I think it wasn't given the right attention. With Rhodey being such a small character, you know, I don't think you can connect to him the same way you could connect, say, with Tony Stark in Iron Man 3 when he gets PTSD.
Yeah.
Like, because he's so minuscule as a character in the MCU, which is actually why I'm really looking forward to Armor Wars, because I feel like that's going to give him so much more character. Like, I like the guy.
Yeah. Yes,
and I enjoy when he's in the films, but they don't give him much. So they finally try to give him something, but because he's so not in focus for so long, it's very hard to sit there and be connected and not feel strange watching that.
Yeah, well, it doesn't. That's the thing. It doesn't really explore it. It's just this happens and he's really injured. And then the next film, he's on his feet again, learning to walk. And then he's just back in the armor and it's like nothing's ever happened. Yeah. And it didn't examine the journey. It didn't examine the progression of sort of, you know, maybe how that made him feel and his sort of humanity. And it did gloss over the idea of, well, he's now disabled. Because he's not disabled. He's just got this massively high-tech prosthesis that basically just makes him even more superhuman. So, I felt watching that, I felt a little bit like, oh, that's not very good representation at all. Then to see how Makari was written into Eternals, I thought it was refreshing. So she's deaf. And she communicates using sign language, and the other characters communicate using sign language. It's not really, it doesn't need to be addressed. It's not made a thing. That, though, I did feel, in terms of story, was a little bit... So, I'm not that clear on the source material, but I believe the character in the comics is male, am I right?
Yeah, male and of Hirin as well.
Yeah, so this is something that I was sort of... So one of the reveals is that the Eternals aren't an alien race as they're sort of believed to be. They're actually basically robots created by the Celestial.
Yeah.
The thing that I didn't really understand is how one of them could be deaf and what purpose that serves in terms of these are engineered to be, you know, superhuman or to have superhuman powers. Or I didn't really understand how deafness factored into that. If there was some sort of advantage or some way that made sense in the narrative for the Celestial to have programmed that into Makari, I would have gone, oh, okay, yeah, sure. But
there was something very small that was, I think, glossed over in the film, and it was the scene, I think it was set in Babylon. Yeah. And she's standing there and the two people are arguing about like robbing her.
Yeah.
And she mentions the fact that even though she's deaf, she can feel the vibrations, so know that they're talking and that they're talking about her. And I think that was probably a bit too glossed over. And I do remember hearing as well, I don't remember if this was just a theory that people came up with or something that the creative team actually spoke about. Yeah. But although not explicitly stated, Makari being deaf is a result of if she can go faster than the speed of sound, it doesn't rupture her eardrums. That was something that I don't know. Again, I don't know if this was the creative team that mentioned it or just the theory that people came up with.
Yeah. But
again, obviously you've got other speedsters in the MCU like Quicksilver and Speed.
Yeah.
But given that they are manufactured, given that the Eternals themselves are manufactured, I could see that being like a plausible explanation that just wasn't explained.
Yeah, see, I mean, that's my philosophy generally is if they explain it and make an effort to explain it, it wouldn't be something that bothered me. I just felt like, again, she wasn't given an awful lot to do. She wasn't, you know, she was introduced at the start with all of them. So it does jump around a lot. There's a lot of sort of, you know, starts at 5000 BC and then jumps ahead and then jumps back and forth. But in the present day scene, she doesn't come into it until quite late in the film. And again, she wasn't given an awful lot of screen time, really, especially in relation to her importance to the plot. You know, in terms of the battle scenes and stuff, she was very much kind of up there with the rest in terms of how useful she was. And it just, yeah, it felt a little bit cheap that she wasn't really explored. But I do think that the ending and the post credits in particular does really set up for her and Druig to not lead the team, but I think they will lead at least the first half of Eternals 2, you know.
Yeah.
So hopefully they can write that going forward. But again, it comes back to my kind of criticism that maybe some of them just weren't quite given enough time and enough development. But yeah, I felt that there was... It was an odd tone overall. It's just a little bit strange in that, and I don't know if you picked up on this or if you might not agree with me at all here, but I felt a little bit like, and I've seen a few things about Chloe Zhao saying that she was inspired by by
Zack Snyder.
Yeah.
Yes,
and
I did pick up on that actually.
It felt a lot like Justice League, like Man of Steel. It felt a lot. It felt almost more like a DC film than it did a Marvel film in a lot of ways, to me.
I think that might be because, like, the Eternals, like, I don't know the characters well enough to specifically say this, but I'm going to say it anyway. From what I can tell, the Eternals feel a lot like the New Gods of DC's comic universe.
Yeah.
And the fact that DC have not done the New Gods at all in their films yet is probably why this feels so much like a DC film, because the closest thing we've had to anything of New Gods relation is probably Zack Snyder's DC films.
Yeah.
And I picked it up. It's the first fight of the film. I think when they get to Earth, and literally watching that scene, I thought to myself, this feels like Zack Snyder's Justice League.
Yeah, I that was sort of my inclination too. But I think for me, it was a lot of so much of it is done with CGI, which it's not really a criticism because they couldn't have done this film without it. It, you know, the deviants needed to be done with CGI. The superpowers needed to be done with CGI. It couldn't really have been done any other way. So it's not one that really I take any offense to. It's just, it's quite extensive. And because basically all of the film's villains are rendered entirely in CGI, it did feel a little bit like Steppenwolf all over again. but it's, I think to me, it was more that the MCU has a very specific tone. There's a sort of, the seriousness is undercut with almost constant comedy. You know, you've always got at least one or two comic relief characters, usually a sort of sidekick type, like your Happy Hogan, Luis in Ant-Man. You know, there's always a comedic element to MCU films. And in Eternals, in a sort of team of 10 people, it's really only Kingo that's funny. And sort of Kingo's ward. What's his name? The sort of,
oh, the valet.
Yeah, I can't remember.
I can't remember his name, but he was probably the funniest thing in that film.
Yeah, he was really funny. And like Kingo's character was excellent too.
Yeah.
And again, you know, Kumail Nanjiani he's really funny. He was a great casting, and he was a real important part of the film, I think, and a really interesting character. So. Hello, this is Niall from the future, which is actually the past now, but less in the past than the time we recorded this episode. Once I came to edit this portion of the podcast, I discovered some horrifically corrupt audio that sounded like two swarms of bees having an argument, so I'm going to need to jump ahead to a point where the bees stop. From what I remember, this is the part where I harped on about Kumail Nanjiani being well cast, and speculated that the MCU would have to work to make Eternals feel like a more natural part of the wider canon. Anyway, as awkward as it is, I'm now going to let past Niall and past Oliver continue with their chat, and I'm going to return my consciousness to my present, which is now your past. Okay. So, speaking of the future, I've got a few little questions here, but first I feel like we need to address the post-credit scenes. So we might as well start with the mid-credit scene. What were your thoughts on that?
I had the mid-credit scene spoiled from the premiere because people were talking about it everywhere. I knew what was going to happen.
Yeah,
but I still did love it. And what I did like in particular is that even though it's only probably what a minute and a half, 2 minutes tops, it expanded that groundwork that the film had already laid out with the Celestials, with Harry Styles as Star Fox, which I'll be honest, I think is a really good choice. Actually.
Yeah, great choice.
I thought he did a really good job, although only 2 minutes. I still think it was a really good choice. But him basically being like the Nick Fury of the Iron Man post-credit scene, but for this scene, saying that there's a bigger universe out there with more Celestials and more Eternals. I think that was great. And I loved how, you know, we've spent 2.5 hours watching this whole new world evolve, and then in this little stinger at the end, it's just expanded it into a size we didn't even know was possible yet this quickly.
Yeah. Well, and again, I think that is something that did link it, not quite backwards, because obviously Star Fox, that's his first appearance, but it does link it back to Thanos a little bit. You know, he's mentioned and it's his brother, and it brings it back by kind of adding, not necessarily a reference to, but it's a promise that going forward, this character is linked with things that have already happened. It just sort of further establishes this is the same world. It's just a different world that, you know, the universe was changed by the events of Endgame. And so this film is different. There's a slightly different tone. It all feels a bit different. But that post-credit scene had a real MCU feel to it. It was quite silly.
Yeah.
It was, I can't remember, what's the little guy's name? Is he called Pip or?
Pip, I think so, yeah.
Something like that. But it's Patton Oswalt, the voice, which again, he's excellent. He could voice anything and it would be funny. But
yep.
He didn't look great. I kind of hope they tweak the way he looks, because he looked a bit, I don't know, just not entirely great. I've seen a few people posting about how ridiculous he looked, but and in sort of in contrast to how good Harry Styles looks as Star Fox, he looks just perfect. Like, they've got the design nailed. And yeah, I felt sort of conversely that the little guy wasn't, he was just done as like, oh, that's funny. He's just a weird little troll man. But no, I think you're right. Overall, I think it's very exciting. And I think it did a really good job of teasing what's coming without saying too much, without doing too much. They've still got room to kind of change things around a bit and play with what's going to happen. But it's pointed to the direction Phase 4 is heading in, which I like. That's what it needs to do. So the end credits scene, I actually missed because I was feeling so ill. I just had to leave the cinema.
No.
I can't sit here for another 10 minutes and wait. So I have read what it is. I'm a little bit annoyed that I missed it, actually, because I thought Kit Harington's Dane Whitman was probably the best character of the film. I know he wasn't really a part of Eternal's story. I mean, he was a very minor part, but his sort of inclusion was basically to set up the character in the future. But I thought he was excellent, and I was a bit annoyed that I missed him. But
even though I thought he was slightly sidelined, being human over, well, whatever he may be, actually, but not being an Eternal, I actually thought it was a very smart decision to give Cersei an established character as her partner.
Yeah.
Because in one hand, it means they can cast someone known and then have that character return if audience like them, which obviously they do. But also, it really humanizes Cersei and builds that connection that the whole film is really about, the fact that Cersei has this connection with mankind, and having her be so connected with a human partner, I think works really well as well.
Yeah, well, so that was basically what I was going to say, is that her relationship with him kind of, that frames the basis of the, well, I can spoil it, can't I? The narrative is basically, it turns out that Icarus is bad and that he wants to cause the emergence and destroy the Earth, and that Cersei is opposing him, and that's why she's been chosen to lead the Eternals, and so on and so on. And I felt like her relationship with Dane Whitman was basically, that was the difference between them, because right up until sort of in terms of their lives quite recently, they were together, they were in love, they were married, they were a couple. And then Icarus has his crisis and he goes off, and then Cersei moves on. And she, you know, he goes off and leaves her, and she establishes herself as sort of more a part of humanity. She kind of, gets more involved in sort of human life. And I think that's the difference between them. And that's, you know, as much as he's not really in it that much, I think the relationship that they have kind of formed the basis for the film's conflict, in that she
100%, yeah.
doesn't see eye to eye with him because she's now in love with a human. And I also think that it seems like with that sort of cliffhanger ending that basically it's going to be the other way around in Eternals 2, with Dane Whitman is now trying to get Cersei back. And so him loving her is basically going to be the reason that humanity gets involved with the Celestials and whatnot, because the rest of the Earth isn't, I mean, it's still up in the air what's going to happen with the Celestials and whether or not they're going to leave Earth alone. I imagine not, you know. But the idea that, you know, Dane Whitman now has this grudge against the Celestials because they've taken Cersei, it sort of flips the basis of Eternals on its head, in that, you know, the Celestials trying to harvest the Earth is the basis of Eternals. But then for a sequel, it will probably be this human going after the Celestials to try and get Cersei back. So, yeah, I thought it was a nice little tweak to the canon. I thought Kit Harington was excellent. I thought he was really, you know, he didn't get a lot of time on screen, but he was quite funny in places. He's very charismatic. And
yeah,
I just think I'm really excited to see more of him in the MCU. So, yeah.
Future of the MCU being so quiet at the moment, like we don't know what our next event is. In one hand, that kind of, it doesn't worry me. It's more that I sit here and watch the next MCU project and the next one and the next one, and they do all these little teases and you really, really don't know where they're going to end up.
Yeah.
And that's something that slightly scares me as well.
Yeah.
Because, you know, using Loki as like the example, that being Kang at the end of Loki,
yeah,
was not the script. That wasn't the plan.
Yeah.
Until they cast Jonathan Majors. They cast Jonathan Majors literally for the throwaway role of He Who Remains.
Yeah.
And then they loved him so much, they offered him Kang and rewrote the script specifically.
Yeah. See, I quite like this. Yeah. I mean, I like this idea that they're going the other way, and that I don't like to know exactly where it's going. I kind of like the mystery of, okay, but now I want to see what happens next. Because as much as I wasn't a massive fan of Eternals, I thought it was a decent film, but I wasn't massively enthused with it.
Yeah.
But I think that's what it does best, really. It does get you interested in where Phase 4 is heading. And as much as, you know, I've got criticisms, I've got things I didn't like, things I did like, I've got things that maybe could have been done better, things that I don't know how they could have done better, but I still didn't like them. But regardless, it has got me excited for Phase 4. The voice at the very end of the end credits is, I mean, it's believed to be Blade. Has that actually been confirmed?
Confirmed as Blade, yes.
It is. That's, yes. I mean, we've known for quite a while now that Blade is coming, but it just builds the anticipation because you're thinking, okay, but now he's appearing. So it is really coming, like, you know.
And in such an unexpected place as well. That's what I really loved about that, because I actually didn't realise it was him. I was in the cinema and I thought, I recognised that voice. The closest thing I could put it to was Jeffrey Wright as the Watcher from What If.
Yeah.
I was like, but that doesn't make any sense. Why would the Watcher be involved with Dane Whitman, Black Knight? That doesn't make much sense to me. And there were actually other people in the cinema that were saying the same thing when I was thinking it, which was quite funny. But then when I left, I looked it up and it was like, oh yeah, it's Blade. And that just opens up a whole new like corner of the MCU, which is something that I was actually going to mention when you were saying about like the future of the MCU as a whole.
Yeah.
Something that I really like is the idea that we don't know what the next Endgame style event is going to be, which is something that I'm really glad about.
Yeah.
The only thing I ever really want to know is this tease going to lead somewhere? Which was always one of my issues with like the X-Men franchise, that they did so many of these after credit scenes that never led anywhere because they didn't know what they actually wanted to do, but just wanted to tease it anyway. But the MCU seems to have that down, and every tease they have will go somewhere now.
Yeah.
And something I love is that we're not just getting one narrative. You know, we're getting a multiversal narrative with like Doctor Strange and Ant-Man.
Yeah.
We're getting the really grounded stuff with like Hawkeye, potentially Daredevil. We're getting seemingly a darker side with like Midnight Suns characters, yeah, with Blade and Ghost Rider, hopefully. You know, there are so many narratives going forward that if you don't like a certain storyline, you just don't have to watch it, and you're not missing out on the MCU because there is so much to offer now.
Yeah, yeah, it's an exciting time, definitely. Right, so what I think we need to do quickly is just blitz through a couple of questions. So I've got one question that's sort of two separate questions, but...
Okay.
Okay. Who is your favourite overall character?
In Eternals?
In Eternals, yeah, sorry.
Oh, that's a hard one because I did like all of them. Yeah. But I would say Icarus.
Ooh, actually. That's...
It was very tight between him and Cersei, but I think it's my love for the fictional Greek hero and the influences that the character had.
Yeah.
And no, I like the twist as well. I thought the twist was very good. I
didn't see it coming. And no. I thought he was excellent. Who is it?
Richard Madden. Yeah.
Madden. Thank you. I could not remember his surname. I thought he was really, really good in that role. Like, he acted it so well.
Yeah.
My favorite, for the record, Gilgamesh. Thought he was amazing.
So many people say Gilgamesh.
I wanted him to have more time. And that's kind of the only thing that makes me feel a bit like, oh, but I wanted him to be on a little bit more. So,
well, the lucky thing for those who have not read the comics is that Eternals, you know, within their name, they don't die. They don't die forever. And once they are destroyed, they are rebuilt. Yeah.
Well, that's the thing. If he was built, you know, by Arishem, then Arishem could just rebuild Gilgamesh and there's a new one. Yeah. That's something that I did think, and I thought, oh, he'll probably come back and he'll be an antagonist, which is actually even more exciting. But yeah, so it might be the same answer, might not be. Which of the Eternals do you associate most with? Because my answer is different to my favourite character and who I feel most connected to.
That's a really good question, because that's like a proper thinker.
Yeah.
And weirdly, I think I'd say Druig.
Do you know what? That's my answer too. There's something about Druig that, I mean, for me, I think the thing, so anyone who's listening who knows me personally, Druig is quite a short, angry, slightly erratically behaved young man. I mean, he's not young, he's thousands of years old, but that's something I associate a lot with. But I thought he was really interesting. A little bit annoying as well, like in terms of the narrative. He was one of those you're like, oh, come on, like just do what we know you're going to do. But I felt he was, one that I definitely wanted to explore a bit more.
100%, yeah.
So, yeah. Okay. What was your highlight or highlights? If you can't choose and you've got a couple of highlights, you know, like best scenes.
Well, anytime Makari is just running, I loved that. It was so different, so fresh to every other speedster we've ever had in any superhero project.
Yeah.
It looked so cool. That opening fight, I think, was still one of my highlights as well.
Mm-hmm.
And just ironically, it's because of my love for Zack Snyder's Justice League and the influence that was on that scene in particular. And my biggest bit is anytime we see a Celestial and when Cersei turns... I forget his name, like Tigamush or something like that. I can't remember his name.
Tiamat.
The one in the earth.
Tiamat.
Yeah, there. Oh, it was close. Yeah. That was pretty close, actually. When she turns him to marble.
Yeah, that was cool.
That was, incredible, in my opinion.
I found it really hard to think of a highlight, but I think for me, I love seeing Kingo's powers. I just thought they were a lot of fun and sort of... both quite useful and quite useless, and I thought, oh, that's interesting. So I mean, Kingo as a character I thought was a bit of a highlight, but also the sort of action scene in the woods when they're in the rainforest, and I thought that was really well done. It sort of captured their kind of desperation being attacked by all of the deviants and not knowing what was going on, and Gilgamesh and everything that happened there, and Yeah, I thought that was, for me, one of the best scenes of the film. So, last question. What was your lowest point of the film? Like, what was the bit you really didn't or could have done without, maybe?
Do you know what? I don't think I had any moments that I specifically disliked, but I could mention something about the filmmaking that I was disappointed in.
Yeah.
Having seen Chloe Zhao's last film, Nomadland,
yeah,
and loving the cinematography, I really wanted the cinematography to be closer to that of Nomadland's quality. And although I think it was probably a bit better than some of the other MCU films we've had in the past, I still don't think it hit nearly as high as my expectations in terms of cinematography, knowing Chloe Zhao's work.
Yeah, I think that's fair. I think it was sort of, yeah, it did feel a bit like cinematic middle ground between sort of slightly more artistic films and what people expect from the MCU. And they were like, okay, well, we'll compromise a little bit, but mostly you have to do it like this. And yeah, I get that. I think for me, the low point in a sort of similar vein was the jumping back and forth, kind of back to Babylon and then back to present day and then back to, you know, the 14th century or something, and then back to the present day and then back to a week before. And I just felt like it could have been done a little bit less confusingly. Maybe it was sort of jumping all over the place and it just messed with the pacing, which I don't know. I feel like maybe that's a bit petty, but that was kind of something that when I was watching, it really stood out as, like, I almost groaned at one point in the cinema because I was just like, oh, just like get on with, I want to see what's happening now, not jumping back to see a conversation that happened 2000 years before that we've already sort of, it's already been explained what happened. You don't really need to examine that any closer, but yeah. No, I think that's it for the questions. We do actually have a couple of pieces of sort of related news stuff. We've got later this week, there is Disney Plus Day. Are you excited for that?
I am really looking forward to it for many, many reasons. And to explain briefly what it is, it's basically Disney Plus's own version of like DC fandom or Netflix's Ta-dum event a couple weeks back. So all throughout the day, at different times throughout Disney's social media platforms, there will be a different type of trailer, announcement, teaser related to only the Disney Plus content we're getting. So we know that Marvel Studios will have their own special that will actually only be released on Disney Plus, talking about the future of the MCU on Disney Plus, which we're likely to get at the very least some kind of She-Hulk trailer or Miss Marvel trailer, and potentially announcements for new shows and specials, because there's been lots rumoured for the past probably year that just hasn't been officially confirmed, which I wouldn't be surprised if gets at the very least a little mention. And then to swap over to the Star Wars side of things, there will be a special released on Disney Plus called Under the Helmet.
Yeah.
The Story of Boba Fett, I believe it's called.
Yeah, yeah.
And that's as it says on the tin, you know, it's going to be a little retrospective on Boba Fett before the show comes out in December. Yeah, nice. And we're also highly likely to get our first trailer for the Obi-Wan Kenobi series, many more announcements as well.
I've got to say, right, I think this is a really nice thing that it's kind of coming into its own now, this idea of they're putting on these little showcases of trailers and announcements, and doing it through social media and stuff makes it so accessible to people and so easy to share and for people to get excited about things. And I mean, I really like that, especially given that, you know, I mean, it's basically now what I do for a living is write about these things. But you know, it is exciting and it builds so much excitement with fans and sort of in communities and stuff. And in terms of sort of PR, it's a great move. It, you know, it really works. But also as a fan, it is so exciting to know, okay, well, this Friday coming, we are going to have so many like announcements and trailers, and we're going to know a lot more about what's going on in the future with this. And, you know, it was the same a couple of weeks ago with fandom. And like, personally, I know we talked about it briefly, but I'm not a massive fan of the DCEU, but seeing the, you know, the new trailers of Black Adam, The Flash, I was actually really excited. And it's done in a way that it does make it exciting. They get, you know, these little featurettes and a little like behind the scenes stuff, and it's just a lot of fun. And I like that they're sort of doing it through social media now because it's so accessible.
Yeah, definitely. It's such a fan experience. And I mean, when they did the Disney Investors Day last December, you know, Disney Investors Day tends to be very corporate, very structured, very boring and bland.
Yeah.
And no one other than the actual investors tend to listen to the audio call. Yeah. But the way they did it last year was absolute. That was probably one of the highlights of that time for me. Because I, you know, it went on for, I think it was about 3.5 hours, and it was just 3.5 hours of non-stop greatness, great stuff, constantly. There was never a point where I was bored with the Investors Day last year. And knowing that this year's Disney Plus Day will not be specifically padded as well.
Yeah.
Because it is just basically a load of like 15-minute specials for different branches of the company.
Yeah.
On Disney Plus. So it's going to be probably even better than Investors Day because there'll be even less padding, even though Investors Day didn't have much padding, in my opinion.
Well, see, that's what, I mean, that was sort of basically kind of my point, I think, really, is that until quite recently, these things have been about showcasing two people in the industry, and then that information trickles down through, you know, journalism and just people writing stuff about it, which, again, I mean, that's how I make a living, so I'm not going to bash it too much. But the idea is they are now announcing these things and showcasing them in a way that it's not just for the journalists and the studio execs and the investors. It's now for the fans as well. And it's so easy to share. And like from a professional standpoint, I now get to write, instead of just sort of relaying what happens in the new trailer, I get to write, you know, a dissection of what this means for the film. Could this be this, you know, this theory explained, all that sort of thing. It's much more exciting from that point of view. And there's so much more to talk about when it's done like that. So yeah, I'm really excited for it.
Yeah, so am I. I'm really looking forward to it. And obviously my account will be flooded with extra information about that as well on Saturday.
Yeah, no. So the only other real kind of news, and it's again related to Eternals, Shang-Chi is coming to Disney Plus this week, is it not?
It is Disney Plus Day.
Yes. So a lot of people, I know a lot of people who haven't seen it yet. I've still not seen it. So I'm actually really excited for that. I'm going to watch it probably on Friday, watch that Friday night. And exciting stuff. Yeah. That actually brings us to the end of this week's podcast. As always, please do go and follow Corner of Film on the social medias. That's Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at Corner of Film. You can also follow me personally at Lord of the Grey on Twitter if you're interested. Oliver can be found on Instagram at Oliver's_reviews, where he posts, I mean, it's daily content, is it not? It's
every day.
You do a lot. So there's loads on there. He reviews a much wider range than what I review at Corner of Film. He does TV as well. You do review some comics sometimes, do you not?
I do sometimes, yep.
Yeah. And so
next one will be the Hawkeye.
Oh, nice. I'll definitely be reading that. Do go and give him a follow, and you'll get a much wider variety than what I can offer you. So lastly, please do subscribe, like, rate, whatever you got, the podcast on your platform of choice. It will help give us a boost, something to do with algorithms. I don't really understand them. We have been Niall and Oliver on the Corner of Film podcast, and you have been... Goodbye.
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 Bye-bye.